Good morning. 7:08 on September the 25th, 2016. A Sunday morning on the road with Charles Corrault. Not exactly. I'm thinking about a lot of stuff this morning. Some of it I can talk about. Some of it I can't talk about. Some of it's not ready to be talked about, I think. I've been having a conversation about disruption and the technical definitions of disruptive innovation. And I've maintained for a while now that the Kindle, Amazon in general, and the Kindle in particular, and to a certain degree, Kindle Direct Publishing, has disrupted reading. The idea that it has disrupted publishing, it doesn't seem right based on what I understand about what the term disruptive technology really means. And the example I used in a recent comment was that the automobile was a disruptive technology, and it disrupted the buggy whip industry, which is perhaps too simplistic an example. It disrupted the transportation industry. Now, a lot of buggy makers went out of business. A few stayed as boutique kinds of operations. Some of them lasted for quite a long time. Maybe 20 years. Some of them went into automobiles. Some of them shifted from coaches to coupes. And the industry that was disrupted was transportation, more than, you know, buggy whip makers. That's kind of a simplistic notion. But the idea that a disruptive innovation eventually supplants the old players. Now, on Clayton Christensen's website, he has some examples, and one of the examples was PCs, personal computers, supplanting mainframes. And the reality is, that's just not true. Because mainframes still exist. They exist for pretty good reasons. A lot of those reasons have been supplanted by blade technology, where a computer room which might have housed at one point one computer now holds thousands of blade computers that are slotted into racks. And connected to a common backbone and network. And so, for a certain application, yeah, PCs have replaced. For the most part, they've replaced pretty much mini computers. Or mid-sized computers. and that shared server space has pretty much supplanted those devices, because the network of personal computers is more powerful and more flexible. So the issue that I've got is that reading can't have been disrupted if it's being replaced. Now, in a certain sense, reading on digital devices has made significant inroads into reading on paper. When we think about what the innovation does, what the innovation means, that the ebook, and I really see this as a two-layered process. The ebook itself has been around for a very long time, and it wasn't until the Kindle came along that the retail populace, the retail population, the larger population of readers, actually adopted ebook as a viable alternative to paper. And Sony Reader has been around. I think Sony Reader might have been the first one. They've been around for a very, very long time. But the problem has been twofold. One, the devices themselves were relatively expensive, and then you had to buy the books that would go, you could read on the devices. And while Gutenberg, Project Gutenberg has been around for a while, and providing content, what they've been providing is old content. What they've been providing is content that is dated, of limited interest to the general reader, generally not the kind of content that readers want. A few do, but the vast majority don't really want to read Moby Dick or Ivanhoe, or a few of them will grab the stories of S.S. Van Dyne or some of the other stuff that's there that's in the public domain. But when the Kindle came along, and they could buy their ebooks right alongside their paperback books, right in the same catalog, right in the same interface, using the same payment methods, using the same trust that they have for Amazon, which admittedly, you have to go back a few years, but the trust in online retailers has been a problem, or was a significant problem for quite a long time. And Amazon has pretty much, I won't say single-handedly, but nearly single-handedly, reversed that people seem to be willing to trust Amazon where they wouldn't trust my site, and they probably shouldn't trust my site. It's one of the reasons that I haven't started selling books on my site again. I'm not sure that I can safeguard it adequately. I did use PayPal. A lot of people don't like PayPal. A lot of people don't trust PayPal. So the Kindle is the device, but the device itself ran into the problem that the bigs didn't want to play along. There was not sufficient content available on the platform to the ecosystem, to the infrastructure, to allow the Kindle to grow, to breathe, to find an audience, to become mainstream, to be adopted by more than the top two standard deviations of readers. the earliest of adopters. And so the real innovation is not the Kindle, it's KDP. KDP, when you look at it from that perspective, and there are people who aren't, I think there are people who don't really understand that KDP, I'm pretty sure, the Kindle really has been around longer than KDP. I may be wrong, they may have come out at about the same time, but that KDP is the innovation that allows Amazon to siphon up all of the loose manuscripts. Monk post. And make them available on Kindle. And it really is that kind of underrepresentation, underserved population of readers who now have a wider selection of content. And some of that selection is, some of that, particularly in the early days, some of that selection was relatively questionable. Some of it was pretty horrible. Some of it still is pretty horrible. There are still scammers. There are still people who scrape the internet for content, package it in a book, and publish it on there as their own. A lot of the how-to books, a lot of the how to do this, really are comprised of scraped content that has been reformatted, repackaged, and claimed under copyright. It's not the important content. That's not the punchline. That's not what gave readers the edge. That's not what, although it's certainly, I mean, there are people who want to read that, there are people who will buy that, there are people who want to know how to do that, and they'd rather read stolen material repackaged for them on the Kindle than they would just Googling it and reading it in the original on the website. It's like, okay, fine. I can't tell you the number of questions that I could have answered with, let me Google that for you. I've actually used let me Google that for you a couple times just because it's like, hello. You know, I know it's easy to ask somebody and they will probably give you an answer, but have you ever thought you could get the answer sooner by just asking the question in an appropriate manner? That will give you instant feedback. I don't want to have to wade through all of the stuff that might be wrong. Okay, fine. Anyway, the thing that I got a little sidetracked, but the idea that reading was disrupted sort of implies that reading goes away, that paperback book reading might go away. And for adult fiction, I think it might be true. It's not ever going to go away. Just like there are still buggy makers today. There are still mainframes today. But I think fiction, particularly adult fiction, has already shifted. Has already pretty much stripped out a lot of the paper readers, has already moved them aside. And there's a lot of research out there, and it's all bogus. What would you prefer to read? Paper or ebook? digital paper. And by and large, over the years, the shift has been away from ebook and toward paper. But that doesn't get to the heart of the question, which isn't which would you prefer to read? It's what do you buy to read? Do you buy paper or do you buy digital? And do you buy, what do you like to read, your fiction? In what format do you buy for entertainment? Buy for paper for reference. Yeah, I don't. That's really good. I can support that. I get that. Textbooks, which is a big part of publishing. You know, it's like when you ask us a truly random sample. You know, what was the format of the last book you read? And one of those persons happens to be a student, the chances are very good that the last book that they read was paper, just because most textbooks are paper. And the e-text movement has really been stymied, has really been crippled by the way publishers supply e-texts. And do really dumb things like make them available only for the life of the course. You can't get them. Once the course is over, the textbook goes away. Now that's just freaking dumb. Because it's a decision that was made by accountants and marketing people and not by educators. It's one of the problems that I have. When I was with the National Center, we actually came to an agreement. There's a handbook, a technical handbook for teachers of the blind and visually impaired, published by the American Federation for the Blind in New York. And one of the things that we did was we went to New York and had negotiations with the publisher in their offices on Fifth Avenue in New York and said, okay, this is what students need. This is what teachers need. The handbook itself is a great resource, but it's a monster. And it is. It's like 7,000 pages. I'm exaggerating because I don't know really how big it is. But there's 90-something chapters. Or whatever. It's probably like 50-something. But it's a big book. It's a big, big book. And you see one printed out and it's like, and this is no exaggeration, it's 3.5 inches thick. It's almost the same size as Riverside Shakespeare, for those who know what Riverside Shakespeare is. And what we wanted was that we wanted students to be able to buy the chapters that they needed for the coursework. Because this is a resource guide. This is not a book where you read from cover to cover. This is a book where you need to know about this particular kind of problem or that particular kind of intervention or this particular technology. You go to the book and you read that chapter. So being able to buy chapters of the book, even at a higher price. So the book is like, the book was $250. And if you did this, did the math, the individual chapters were 75 cents or something. It was ridiculous. And what we negotiated was that they were able to sell the chapters for $2 or $3 or whatever it was. And the students could download them and keep them forever, those chapters. So if they needed to refer back to it in a later course or later in their careers or whenever, they had the book. They still had that digital chapter saved in a format that they could use. They could actually print it out. They could do pretty much anything they wanted with it except sell it or give it away. And we negotiated that because that was something that was needed. But this is well before. Geez, I'm trying to think of when that was. This was, I think this was before I got my PhD, so it would have been before 2004. In fact, I'm pretty sure it was like a year. It was like, it was something like 2000, 2001. So I've been thinking a lot about what does this disruption mean? And it could mean that there really isn't a disruptive technology. I don't. My argument that it's not disrupting publishing is that publishing isn't going away. It's expanding. Instead of a few hundred, there are now a few million publishers. Instead of a few hundred buggy makers, there are now millions of buggy makers. And the process of publishing hasn't really changed. You still write the book, you still edit the book, you still package the book, you still make the book available to retailers. You still sell the book. The retailers sell the book. And as publisher, you still have some leverage to make those sales go better. The process itself hasn't changed. At any rate, I'm at the back gate. Tomorrow's another day. And with any luck at all, I'll talk to you then.